Well, I think this is everybody today. Julie is not feeling well. And then Marion had an appointment, and Rita was taking Anne to an appointment, and Joyce was not feeling well. She said, yeah, she said not to, yeah, she said she's not, yeah, yeah. Yeah. All right. So I will pray and then we can get started. I think we will finish today. I think it depends. I guess if we get off on a topic, we may not, but I think we will.
Just ask Kyle to come in.
All right. Lord, I just thank you so much for this beautiful day that we get to come together and study your word. I am so grateful for the opportunity to get to study and dive deeper into your word and to get you to know you more intimately. I pray that as we go about our study today, that our eyes and hearts would be open to what you have to share with us today, this morning, and that we would just be teachable in what we learn. In your name, amen. Okay, so let's go back over. Last week we did those last three verses of 8, and then we got into the first 20 verses of 9. So I feel like, Terry, I think maybe you were the only one who was here last week, right? Yeah, I wasn't sure. Yep, we have to, yep, I know, sorry. Yeah, we got through the first 20 and then we'll, or I guess really the first 19 actually, we're doing 20 today. So Terry, do you want to summarize or you want me to?
I can summarize.
All right, go for it. Yep, we did the last three verses of 8. Yep.
So the Jews were happy.
No, it's all right. Here, I'll. So that those. No, no, that's fine. Yeah, and you can jump in wherever. Yeah. Nope, you're fine. So a couple weeks ago when we had Kyle come in, I said that when I read verses 15, there was the blue and white and the great golden crown and the purple. And so I was like, oh, that's like a picture of Christ. And maybe Mordecai is a type of Christ. And then Kalmesha kindly said, no, that's probably not the greatest connection. And I was, that's fine. So then we had Kyle come and share, you know, maybe how to make good connections through scripture. So anyway, but in reading those verses, something that did stand out when I was talking to Kyle was, it does portray a picture of royalty that, you know, we see that the gold and the purple and the linens, that it's giving you a picture of what royalty should look like. So then when Christ goes on the cross and he was dressed in the cloak and then they ripped it off of him and placed a crown of thorns on his head, it just sets up this such a mockery of him, you know, because he is the only king and they dressed him like that, but then they made a total mockery out of it. So then the Jews were joyful because now this new edict was put out, now they had, they were able to take care of the edict that was put out so that they weren't annihilated. So there was feasting and joy and gladness, and they were going to have this holiday, which was Purim, which we're going to get to talk about today. And let's see. We talked about how then it finally was the 12th month, finally the day that they were going to be able to enact the first edict, which was Haman's edict. So this day that we've kind of been waiting for six chapters almost. And then it goes on to talk about how they had killed 500 men in Susa in the citadel. That was in verse 6. And they also killed the 10 sons of Haman. And they list out their names, which just emphasizes who they were, which is interesting and ironic because Haman was so proud of them back in chapter, was it 5, when he was talking to his wife. He was so proud of his sons. And he said, look at, you know, all the things that I've done. And he included his sons in that. And so then here their names are listed out in their death. And it's just, it's emphasizing that, you know, he took such great pride in that, but now it was their destruction was recorded. And then let me see if there was any other highlights. Many more were killed in total. In verse 16, it said 75,000. Esther had also asked for a second day to extend this killing. And we, from her character, we don't think that it was just out of her trying to be vile or bloodthirsty. It was just she wanted to eradicate any hate that may be left. So she asked the king for another day.
So my question is, because everyone was thrown into an uproar when the original decree was issued, right? Mm-hmm. It says all of Susa was in confusion.
Sure.
Who is it now that's, like, now that they know the Jews are able to fight back, who is it that's carrying out this original order?
I think it's all the people who still would carry the same hate that Haman. Just like with Hitler and the Nazis, there would have still, even with Hitler gone, there was still people who were going to carry out his plan because they carried the same hate that Hitler did for the Jews. They were fed and brainwashed with the very same hate that he had. So they were going to make sure his plan happened regardless of him, you know, as leader being there or not. So I think it's these people. Now, the number may be
less,
a little less, maybe, but we don't really know because...
But I just think, like, now, well, you would think, maybe not, you would think that now everybody knows that the queen is a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, who's going to stand up really against the king because he's such a hothead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like the risk, that would be a big risk. But then I thought, well, maybe do they have to because of the original edict? So someone has to.
Right.
I think, from what,
75,000 was in verse 16. It said 75,000.
But isn't that over?
Yes, for everywhere.
Everywhere, right, the province.
Probably a small percentage. I mean, they have a lot of people.
A lot of commentators said they think that possibly these numbers here might be exaggerated because it says that in Susa, the citadel, in verse 6, that there was 500 men. Now, remember the citadel was just that one localized area. And so they
The whole city?
Right.
They're saying not even the whole city.
Right, because... let's see. The citadel was the plot where the palace was, if I remember right, because then Susa, the capital, or where other places it says Susa, the, what's the other word? Anyway, is the more outlying beyond that. And so they thought possibly the 500 and the 75,000 might be a bit of an exaggeration, but it's what was translated from the original, so it's hard to say. So in verse 6, where it says the 500 men wasn't just in the citadel, and then 75,000, from
everywhere.
And then there was that next day. But I do think, I mean, we've seen it many times in history. Right. You know, you have all these people who are, they hate them. And so they're going to make sure that it happens because that's their worldview also, that they should be eradicated. And so I think it was those people specifically that were carrying out this order.
Well, and if Satan, who has many times tried to exterminate Jews,
right,
if he was part of this as well, he's still going to try it. He's going to keep trying.
Yep. Right. Yeah.
Now, was there any comment last week about them not taking any of the plunder?
Yes. So a big part of that is, even though in the edict that Mordecai put out, he said, you guys go ahead, you can take the plunder. A big reason why they think that they didn't indulge in that is because, kind of twofold. For one, back when Saul killed everybody, but he kept King Agag and they took a lot of the plunder. Well, they're thinking that here maybe Esther was trying to reverse that and say, well, he did that, but we are not going to partake in the plunder because then
they
weren't supposed to. And then they can say, for anyone who might think they were doing it for ill gain, that they were just trying to be bloodthirsty or get rich, that they could say it was for no other reason other than to save their own lives.
Yeah.
They weren't just trying to get wealthy off of them. It was truly just to save their lives that they eradicated them. So that's what was, yeah. All right. So, and then the king does allow for that second day of killing. And more were killed that day. All right. Anything else before we go on? Or any questions?
No, I thought it was interesting the sons were killed, but then later displayed.
Right. Yes. Yep. They were. Yep. When Esther asked for the second day of killing, then she also asked that they be hung on the gallows. And so they were hung. Right.
Now displayed. So that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And whenever, like we've talked about a few times, whenever somebody was hung or impaled on a tree, that was a sign of God's curse on them. And so, and then it also for the city, it was just to bring shame upon their body, to hang them for all to see. All right. So before we get into those verses, I actually am going to go back to, 18 and 19, because as I was studying through for today, I could not figure out why there was this distinction of when, where it says, verse 18, but the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th day and rested on the 15th day, making a day of feast and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who lived in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting. So why there was this distinction between those who were in Susa, the citadel, and those who were in the outlying areas, why was it different when they were to hold their feast? There was like two different days that they should be holding their feast, depending on where you lived. And so I'm like trying to rack my brain why that is. And almost none of the commentaries were helpful in that department. And so I spent quite a bit of time researching. Well, then I finally came across this paper from this precepts. It was a guy, I think it was like his thesis paper or something. I don't know. But he said it was like what gave me the light bulb moment. The reason for the difference of holding their feasts on different days is because when she asked for the second day, that second day of feasting, it was just for Susa. Because it says in verse 13, and Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. Does anybody else's version say anything different? Like Susa, the...
It just says who are in Susa.
Who are in Susa.
According to the edict of today.
I wonder if it was the Holman. I should have double checked. But I think it was the Holman. Let me just look really quick. Anyway, so when she's asking for that second day, those who are in Susa, she's really just asking for the edict to be extended just in that area of Susa. She wasn't asking for the entire province of the whole empire. She was asking just for in Susa.
So just that, in Susa, they did the 14th and 15th. So then they celebrated
the 13th and the 14th.
So
right.
On the 15th. Everyone else just did the
13th. Everyone else just did the 13th. Right. Right. Well, but then when the feasts are actually put into place, the outlying areas would have celebrated. Or maybe that's what
14th.
She said, just on the
yeah.
14th. And then the city of Susa celebrated on the 15th because that was their day of rest.
They had 2 days of killing.
Right, right. So maybe to anyone else that didn't seem like a big deal. But to me, it was a big deal because I could not figure out. I'm like, it doesn't make any sense why they're distinguishing these two things. But I thought that was really interesting. So you even today, they don't necessarily – they're – I did look up, I don't know who it is that determines when they celebrate Purim, but it changes between February and March. Just like kind of like how Easter can sort
well,
of change
on.
Yes, right, right. But so even it sounds like sometimes depending on where you are, you might celebrate it on a different day. It might, one person, one area might celebrate it this day, another area might celebrate it this day, depending on if you, there was a lot of things that were saying, well, this this one paper said, depending on if you were in the walled city or the unwalled city or, you know, all this stuff. So it's a lot to keep track of, but I just thought that was interesting because she did only ask for in Susa. All right. So then on to verse 20. If somebody could read for us verses 20 through, let's go through 28. 20 through 28.
Then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month of Adar, and the 15th day of the same month annually, because on these days the Jews rid themselves of their enemies, and it was a month which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to disturb them and destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme, which he had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation and according to their appointed time annually. So these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And these days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews or their members, or their memory fade from their descendants.
Sweet. Thank you. All right, so verse 20, and Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far. So some people speculate, really none of the commentators that I read really believe that this is true, but other people that they studied out said that they think that possibly this verse could mean that Mordecai was the one who wrote the Book of Esther. But there's really no hard evidence for that because it doesn't say that. and then Mordecai would be writing.
But is it still possible or not?
It's possible, yes. Okay. We just don't have hard evidence saying that it is. Because then other people think that it had to have been maybe a Persian. I mean, it, you know, like we talked about last week, whoever it was very well versed in both Jewish and Persian culture. And so it does make it possible for Mordecai. It doesn't rule him out, but it does make it possible. We just don't know for certain.
Okay. It says, well, J. Mac, John MacArthur, says Mordecai, Ezra, and Nehemiah have been suggested as authors. Mm-hmm. Or somebody we don't. No.
Right. Yep. All right. So, and then these things is just, it's referring to historical events that happened leading up to this point. When it's, and then sent letters to all the Jews writing about it. Because after this killing happened, the Jews wouldn't have all necessarily known what happened throughout the whole empire. And so now Mordecai is writing down a letter to send out to all the Jews to let them know we were successful everywhere. Right. Yep. Verse 21, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month, Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year. So Mordecai is encouraging them to have a formalized celebration. A lot of them probably did celebrate because at the end of the day, they in their own area probably saw success, you know, in at least eradicating some of the hate. But now, you know, so I'm sure they had celebration because of that. But now he is formally letting them know we are going to make this into a holiday that will be remembered and celebrated from year to year so that we can pass this on. Because, right, anytime there is a celebration or a feast, it's to pass on to the next generation who may not have witnessed it to remember what happened. You know, we've seen that back with the Israelites, there was feasts that were implemented back in the beginning, And it's so that they, not only for you yourself who may have witnessed it can remember, but for those generations that are going to come after you. So he is just implementing this formalized celebration, letting everybody know that we are going to celebrate on the 14th and the 15th day, depending on where you live. This was another reversal that the Jews now get to make the decisions rather than simply being subject to them as they were in the beginning. In the beginning of Esther, you know, they there was an edict put out against them. And even Esther, you know, she didn't really get to decide whether she went to the, from what we understand, she didn't get to decide whether she went to the palace or not. And now there is this reversal that now the Jews are calling the shots because Esther and Mordecai have been put in this place. So now they get to call the shots. So that's, you know, an incredible reversal to be able to be in that kind of position in the empire that they were in at the time. Verse 22, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the months that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So Mordecai is giving the reason. He's just reminding them of the reason for their celebration. And it's that they got relief from their enemies. So they slaughtered them, and now they don't have the hatred that they had. Now, again, it from what it seems, the empire as a whole was not necessarily hostile to the Jews at this time. But there would have been individuals within that who would have been in this, like we already talked about, in the same worldview point as what Haman was. And so they were going to make sure that his plan was carried out. And so this was an incredible thing for them to have that relief. Because just, you know, seven months prior, they were fasting and because of out of fear of what was going to happen to them.
So, okay. Haman casts his lots, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like he casts his lots in like the second month.
Yeah, the first month, yeah.
Oh, the first month. It's not until the 12th month.
Right,
and
right.
And then all this happens pretty soon after,
mm-hmm.
right?
So
everyone still has to wait like months
yes,
and months.
Yes, because when Mordecai's edict went out, that was still only in the third month of the year. So they still had like 7 months, which I thought was a little interesting that he was so hurried in getting the message out. It said they sent it on the fastest horses.
Yeah.
But I think truly from what the commentators think, it was just so that everyone had time to prepare for it. So, you know, they were
like
getting right.
Half a year or more.
Right. You did. Yeah.
Until
and,
this day. That's just
right.
so weird.
I know.
We're going to go out and kill each other, but it can only be on this day. No surprise attacks.
No. Alistair Beggs in his sermon on it, he said he was like, this would have been such to the person who hated the Jews. They would have marked this on their calendar like a holiday. Like this
yeah.
would have been such an exciting day and
can't
they would have couldn't wait for it to come, you know? And so, yeah, I know. It's,
but then they would have also known that, oh, well now.
Right. Right
they
now there is
fight against
mm-hmm.
me.
Right.
So what were the Jews supposed to do before? Just roll over dead? I mean, like,
I don't know. I don't know what the laws, I mean, it's.
Maybe now they could acquire weapons, whereas before they
sure.
weren't allowed to or something like that.
Right. Yeah. I know. I'm not sure if it was just because of it being an edict that it was a law that they had to kill the Jews that you weren't allowed to defend yourself, unless this other edict came about. I don't know. I didn't find much about that. But
interesting. The first edict, is it possible that somehow they tried to keep the information from the Jews?
Well, but Mordecai is like mourning and wailing and
the whole city of Susa is mourning.
Yeah, in where he lives, but in the whole kingdom. I don't know.
I mean,
I think it
would have gone out. I think typically an edict would have been known by all
in
the empire. Yeah.
Hear me,
yeah.
Hear you.
Right. Right. Or even posted.
Yeah.
Like I think it's in the VeggieTales Esther that they post. They posted on the little billboard in the middle of the town. Oh, man. All right. So, yeah, so Mordecai is, he's in verse 22, he's giving the reason for the celebration, and that was that they got relief. They're going to commemorate this reversal, this huge, huge reversal. It was just incredible that they were able to defend themselves against the first edict. Purim is not to be a celebration of a massacre or a vengeance on enemies. It's closely associated with the positive idea of rest and enjoying community and joy and gratitude. So they weren't just celebrating that they got to, you know, kill all these people. It was truly to enjoy finally having some rest from the hatred that would have been shown them by those who carried this worldview. So it was a positive celebration as opposed to being excited about who they killed. They were celebrating a first-hand deliverance. You know, they would have been passed down the stories of their those who went before them who were rescued out of slavery. And, you know, now they are experiencing firsthand what God promised, that he would bless them and that he would keep them and that, you know, he would keep their nation. And they are now getting to experience that firsthand. So that is a very important thing to celebrate. And I'm sure some of them, you know, who knows what they had thought about that promise handed down, whether they truly believed it or not, or whether it was just kind of like, well, yeah, that's what grandpa says, you know. But now they are experiencing it for themselves.
It looks like in verse 22 that they are, in the letters that he sent, they're having assuming the letters were sent in a timely, shortly after fashion, and that shortly after that, they were having a holiday and a feast.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, it became an annual tradition.
Right. Yep.
So at first, it was a month later.
Well, at first, it would have, like the very, very first, it was just celebration because they were just excited that they,
right,
you know, were able to save their life. And then that happened, and then Mordecai sends a letter saying, we're going to have a formal feast of, we are going to keep this year after year. So I don't think it was like they had another feast a couple months later. I think it was just,
They had feast.
Right. And so then he's saying, now we will keep that as a feast year after year. So next year it will be a formalized as a whole. We will celebrate that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. So I got to do some digging about Purim. And it was really interesting just getting to dig into how they would have celebrated that now traditionally. And just like any holiday, there's a lot of things I think that are added and maybe taken away from, you know, I mean, as the years go on, there are things. And it's the Jews. So they made a law about everything. Like I was reading, there's a book out there called 250 questions that I forget what the rabbi's name is, but it was some rabbi. 250 questions that he was asked about Purim. And when you read it, I mean, it's just like legalistic stuff. Like, am I allowed to do X, Y, and Z? So I'll get into a little bit of it, but it was just really, I'm like, you know, leave it to the Jews to literally make a law about every possible thing.
Like,
am I able to breathe in this moment? Like, you know, am I able to brush my teeth this morning? Like, it just is crazy. Anyway. So I think we kind of talked about this before, but Purim is taken from pure, which is to cast lots, which is in the very beginning when Haman cast lots to even decide when this killing spree would happen. That's where the name comes from. But pure is the word for lots. That's where they get Purim. For this year, the date fell on March 9th through 10th. Next year, it'll be February 25th through the 26th. So I just thought that was interesting. But it is very celebrated still. I mean, very, very, very celebrated. It's not just kind of brushed under the rug. They definitely celebrate it. So some of the things that they did, well, here's kind of the order of how they celebrate it. The Sabbath before Purim, they will read Exodus, where did I write it down? Yeah, they'll read Exodus 17:8-16. We can read it real quick. Exodus 17, 8 through 16. Mm-hmm. So Exodus 17, 8 through 16, if someone wants to read that for us.
Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out. Fight against Amalek tomorrow, and I will station myself at the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hands up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hands down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial, and recited to Joshua that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation.
Great, thank you. Yeah, so they will read that to just remind them of really where this all started. They'll read that on the Sabbath beforehand. Then the day before Purim, they will fast in honor of the fasting that the 3 days of fasting that had happened when Esther was pleading with the king. So that's just the day before. Then on the day of Purim, they will read Esther twice from they call it the Megillah, which is just the book of Esther. So the rabbi reads it in the morning and then also in the evening. And it says, if you could not attend the synagogue, a rabbi will send you a Megillah so that you can read it if you're not able to be there for the reading, because it was very important that you hear it. While they would read the book, Esther, anytime they came to the name Haman, I think it was Haman and Xerxes. I know for sure it was Haman. They gave the kids these little groggers, these noisemakers, and they would yell and swing the little groggers around and make a lot of noise because they were trying to drown out the name of Haman because of his evilness. They were trying to stomp out his name. So every time his name was read, they would make lots and lots of noise. They would read it from a handwritten scroll. The Megillah was written from a handwritten scroll. On Purim, you were to give to two needy people. So people who were poor or who didn't have a lot for their own. You were to give you could either do a food gift, like a basket, or you could give money. And if you didn't, it said if you didn't know anyone, then you could give to your synagogue who was collecting money for the poor. And then they would distribute it. And one of the things I read said specifically that anybody who asked on Purim for a donation, you had to give some form of something. It specifically said without checking their bank account first. So anybody that was, so I'm sure there's those who would take advantage of that. But you were supposed to give it without checking. And then several of the things I read, like I said, there's a book of 250 questions that were asked about this. So there was the laws of giving. So the mishloach was the gift basket that you were to give to people. So there's all these laws about how to give it and what to put in it and all kinds of things. But I just thought it was interesting. It must be sent and delivered during the daylight hours of Purim. So you were to gather this basket of at least two items of food that were ready to be eaten. It could be a drink. It could be, one person said like potato chips or a bag of cookies, but it had to be ready to eat food. And you had to have at least two items in there.
Oh my goodness.
I know. the sender and receiver.
All it says is gifts.
I know.
To the poor.
I know. I was just laughing.
Giving portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor.
That's why I was just. That's why I was just dying laughing, reading all of these laws and restrictions of what they've made. The sender and receiver must be observing. Must give and receive it in the same day of Purim. Like it wasn't, you couldn't like send it off and then give it another day.
So like put it in the
mail. Right. Another thing is you weren't supposed, like if I was giving one to you, I wasn't supposed to just hand it to you. You had to give it through a third party. So either you hire somebody to come and deliver your gifts,
right,
or during the feast, the time you were gathered together, you would use the kids throughout and you could give the kid it to the kid and the kid would go give it. Who knows? I have no idea why. I don't know. They just like make up all these rules because apparently they have nothing better to do. I don't know. If you were over the age of 13, so past bar mitzvah, you had to give a gift. Anyone over the age of 13 had to give a gift to at least one other person.
It wasn't like your family, like our family makes a basket.
You could, on behalf of your family, given, but still each person in the family had to give if you were over the age of 13. So like you and Kyle couldn't give.
So we would have to give two baskets.
Right.
And then when Abby's 13, we have to give three baskets.
Right. Yep. Anyone over the age of 6 was encouraged to give a miss. I forget how you pronounce it. Mishla. I think that's Mishla. That's just the gift of basket. Anyone over the age of 6 was encouraged to give a basket to practice for when they, got to.
Two poor people. So that'd be two baskets?
Wait.
Well, you were to give to two needy people, you said.
Yes. Yes. You had to give to two. You had to give to two needy people, and you were to give gifts to your fellow friends or family or whatever. But you had to at least give to two needy people, for sure. There was a baseline.
Each person had to give to two. So like me and Kyle each give one, and that's two. Or do we each? Have
I
to give
think
two?
Every person had to give to two needy people, and then beyond that, you could choose who you were going to gift more baskets to. But I think everyone
could give just food to friends.
Right, okay. Right, yes.
Terry,
you know.
I know.
Okay, so then this I just don't even understand this. You are not to send a mishla to a mourner, but the mourner is still obligated to send their mishla to other people.
So they're not going to get anything.
I don't know. I couldn't find anywhere that gave a reason as to why that was, but it was in all of the laws of many different articles.
Sad.
I read. I know. That's what I thought. Right. He would be given. Right. Why would he be the one who's still obligated? Yeah, he should be not obligated. But anyway, so bizarre. Men are to send to men. Women are to send to women. I said they were to be delivered by a third party. What else? It was considered praiseworthy if you sent more than what you were expected. You know, that was, if you just sent the minimum of the two, then that you were just mediocre. But if you sent more than that, you were praiseworthy.
So these laws that you are reading apply to the poor people's gifts or the
Everybody.
Like
everybody, whether you're poor or wealthy.
Right. This is either type of.
Yes. So the poor were still expected to give, within their means, I suppose. But the poor were still expected to give, even of the little that they had. It did say, though, that it was expected that if a wealthy person was giving to a poor person, he still needed to give a wealthy gift, because even though he's just, and then if a person is giving to a wealthy person, they were supposed to match that they were a wealthy person. They weren't supposed to, they were supposed to give out of abundance, as opposed to like, well, you're wealthy, so I'm only going to give you a bag of potato chips. You were supposed to give kind of an, exorbitant gift to that person.
The wealthy person gives the poor person the gift, and now I have something. I have
Right. Yeah, maybe.
Probably.
I don't know.
Poor people hope they get their gifts in the morning, so they can get their gifts out before the sun sets.
And most people didn't gather for the celebration until the mid-afternoon time. There was supposed to be that reading in the morning, the first reading, and then they were supposed to gather in the afternoon for the celebration time where you would have passed out the gifts. I mean, you could send your gift earlier. You could hire somebody to come and take it and deliver it, but I'm just like, oh my gosh. But like I said, anything that was put in your basket to give had to be food that was ready to eat. It wasn't like, it wasn't like a potato that you're going to have to cook. It had to be food that was ready to eat. Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't it just crazy? Just legalistic on everything. I know.
Well, and I think part of it is they want to make sure that they do it right.
Right.
You know, but then their focus is then on the rules and not the heart right. behind it.
The wrong thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what this book.
Giving to the poor and to give to each other.
Right.
Instead of,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, right. I mean, that's what all the 250 questions in that book, all of the questions were legalistic. Like, am I allowed to give in the morning? I'm trying to remember what some of them were. But I mean, you just read them all and you're like, really? Are you really asking these questions? Like, because they thought it had to be such a certain way. And if they didn't do it that way, then it wouldn't be recognized the right way. And you're just like, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. In studying, I came across several articles compiling stories about Purim, and it was so interesting because all of these stories about Purim are over the years. So, I mean, up until even today, these stories were talked about. And so one of the stories was when Jews were being held in the Nazi camp. And it was Purim, and they were still going to try to celebrate. So in the middle of the night, they're in the barracks, and they're just starving. They're so thin from having been starved. So in the middle of the night, one of the guys jumps out of his barrack, and he stands up, and he's like, we are still going to celebrate. And so he starts he started talking about Esther. He was trying to briefly summarize. He didn't have it memorized. But because I don't know if you guys remember, but back in the intro, I said that the Germans did not allow the Jews to have a copy of Esther because they knew the hope that it would give them in the midst of what they were going through. So they were not allowed to have a copy of that.
Were they allowed to have a copy of the rest of the scripture?
I'm not positive. I just remember reading specifically they were not allowed to have Esther if they found it was taken away. Yeah. So this man jumps up and he starts, you know, summarizing Esther and why they would celebrate Purim. And then he starts talking out against Hitler. And all the guys in the barracks, yeah. Their hope is building because of this. You know, yes, in one sense, they're like, oh, how are we supposed to celebrate this when we're going to die, you know? Well, then the next morning, one of the soldiers comes and he had heard that they had this kind of more joyous, you know, happening. And he had heard that they were chanting against Hitler in whatever he was saying. And so he said, you need to tell me right now who it was that, you know, gave this little speech. And everybody was just silent. They weren't going to give it up because they knew what would happen. So everyone was silent. And so he said, all right, then you're going to get your punishment. So he forced them to run. And as they ran, they would whip them and hit them with the back ends of their guns. And then at one point, they started shooting them in their legs. And this went on for hours and hours and hours. And nobody would give up who it was that did it. And they said at the end, I mean, I think it was almost an entire day that they kept after these guys. At the end of all that, I mean, you can just imagine these guys are already so frail and haven't had much food. I mean, we've seen the pictures where you can see their rib cages because of how malnourished they were. And at the end of that, not one of those men died, which is just like, I was just sobbing when I read that because I'm like, now, not only did you save them back here in Esther, but now even in the remembrance of them, the Lord preserved them in that time. And I'm like, man, that is just, it's so crazy. Just so amazing to see that. And then another story, a very similar story that I read. It was all these Jews. I forget where the city was, but they were somewhere where they were hostile towards Jews at that time. And there was a prince who had gotten sick, and then the people of the community thought it was the Jews' fault, so they all wanted to kill them. Well, it was Purim, and the Jews were, they still went out, and they quietly held their Purim celebration. And they told them, they're like, don't make the noise like you normally would, because if they hear us, they're going to come and kill us. Well, one of the little boys got a hold of something to make noise and started making noise during the, whenever they would say Haman. So then they were afraid because they knew that the people were going to hear them. Well, they heard somebody approaching where they were and fearing that it was someone coming to kill them. And it was the prince had woken up to the sound of that ringing and wanted to see what it was. And so he was excited about what they were doing. And so he was like, oh, that's really neat that the prince wasn't hostile towards them. But he said, it's really neat that you guys are still celebrating. So again, he was able to protect those Jews' lives in that instance. And he told them, no, you're not going to kill these people for what they've done. I enjoyed their little story that they told or whatever. And so again, it was like another opportunity that they were supposed to be killed and God spared them. And so I'm like, wow, even through all of these years of celebrating, you know, there was different points where through even just celebrating that God spared those people, which is amazing. So it was really interesting just reading the history of celebrating all of that. So after they would have the reading in the morning, then in the afternoon, they would gather their friends or family together for their festive, like their meal. It would typically begin at sundown and last well into the evening. They would have their little party of food. The table was to be beautifully decorated with a beautiful tablecloth and candles, and they would eat challah and meat and wine and have, you know, an extravagant meal to celebrate. They would sing songs, and then they would again read Esther in the evening. There was a pastry called pastry called a hamashen. It's a three-pointed filled pastry. So it's like a triangle, and inside there's a filling, and it's folded over. And so they said it was called the hamashen. I think that's what it was, how it was pronounced. The hidden filling was to allude the nature of the hidden miracle, how God was hidden throughout this whole story, but yet saved them. And so that's, it alludes to kind of that hidden nature of the story. The three corners represent, there was a little bit of conflict as to what this represented, but they think that it represented either the three-cornered hat that Haman would have worn. There's some pictures that Haman's depicted with this hat, kind of like a gesture hat that has three corners on it. So they think maybe those three corners represent that. Or it could also represent that his triangular ears that Haman had. Apparently he had three-pointed ears. another thing that was pointed out in the feasting was there was to be excessive drinking, to the point which when the story of Esther was read, you should have been so intoxicated that you could not make out whether it was Haman who was being said or Mordecai who was being said. Because whenever they said Haman, they would say Haman the cursed. And then whenever they said Mordecai, it was Mordecai the blessed. So they were supposed to be so plastered that they couldn't tell which name was being said. Again, who comes up with these rules?
So then you would just be making noise at the wrong points.
I guess so.
If you can't tell.
One of the reasons
if you can even remember at that point to make noise.
Right. One of the reasons they said that that could have been instituted was because then God was to be equally praised both for Haman's downfall and for Mordecai's elevation, because they couldn't tell either one, and God's orchestrated the whole thing, and so you were to praise regardless. And like, what an excuse to get drunk. I know. And they even said it was to give a greater spiritual awareness under the influence. Like, oh my goodness. I know. No. Oh, just crazy.
Yeah, even in Proverbs.
I know. So then another thing I didn't say earlier was that a lot of times, sometimes adults would have come to the festivities whenever they gathered for the feast. They would have come dressed up in a costume. More often, though, it was the kids who came dressed up. And they said that that was another kind of allusion to God being revealed, concealed in the story. And so they were concealing themselves in character. A lot of times they would dress up as either Mordecai or Esther if they were to dress up. So.
But today, isn't it?
Today it sounds like, Halloween. Right. It does sound like they just kind of dress up as whoever. I saw a lot of pictures that, yeah, people were just dressed up as whatever, somebody in costume. But yeah. And again, none of that is in the Bible, so it's just how they have taken it. All right, I think that was everything that I, yeah. Okay, so then I gotta get back to Esther. Verse 22. As the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts and of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So again, they're just like what we just described. That's then what traditionally would have happened year to year. And again, like I said, it still carries to this day. It's a big deal. So nowhere do we have instruction to give obvious praise for God for delivering the people. Like in this section, there's no, like Mordecai doesn't specifically say you are giving praise to the Lord for your deliverance. He just says there's feasting and gladness because you got relief from your enemies. So again, we are not seeing a direct, you know, honor giving to the Lord, which has been the theme of the whole book. And I mean, in so every other feast that we come across of the Jews, it is central. That idea of giving thanks to the Lord is central. It's you're giving your first fruits to the Lord. You're giving your firstborn. It's always central, is you're giving the honor back to the Lord. And so it's just interesting that again here we don't see any indication of we are celebrating on behalf of what the Lord did. It just possible, but it's also seems to be indicative of Mordecai's faith in a sense. You know, I mean, when there's nothing recorded that he seems to have such a great, you know, if he was truly living out his life for the Lord in faithfulness, then you would think he would incorporate in here, we are going to give thanks to the Lord for what he did in saving us, because we shouldn't have been saved. So it's just interesting that there's nothing indicated on his part that we should celebrate, you know, be grateful for what he did. So I personally think that's indicative of where he stands in terms of prioritizing the Lord in his life.
I think that plays into part of the point of Esther, is that, because like you've said before, God is so glaringly absent.
Mm-hmm.
Places where it would be so easy to put him in, he's not there.
Right.
And it's almost like God continues to preserve his people through pagan empires and almost through pagan Jews.
Right.
You know,
right.
God still is working, and he still fulfills his promises to wipe out the Amalekites all the way back in Exodus, you know, even through totally pagan societies, and even when his own people don't seem to recognize him, God is still at work to work out his plan and fulfill his purposes.
Right. And I mean, if we simply remember that this is God's inspired word, you know, this is his inspired word. So if it was meant to be there, it would be there, you know, it would be evident there, and it's not there. And so then I think that gives me such a great hope that, wow, he is even using the pagan to accomplish his purpose, or, you know, the one who is not so,
days.
Right. Right. Yes, especially these days, that his plan will never be thwarted. It will always be accomplished and played out exactly as he planned it from the very beginning. He didn't just look ahead and say, oh, well, they're going to choose this and you're going to choose that, and then make his plan based on that. It was planned from the very beginning of time. And that is such a great hope to rest in for us for right now in the time that we live in. And really all of eternity, it has been a great hope to rest in. Because what we're dealing with now is nothing new. Yeah. So it's just interesting that it's almost as if, you know, they could have had on their coffee mugs and spirits. Esther is the reason for the season, like, you know, in how they're viewing why they're going to celebrate this holiday, you know, just like as we approach the holiday season. I mean, how easy it is for us to not place God where he should be, you know, that we get so wrapped up in all the details of how the holiday is supposed to be played out, just like the Jews did with Purim. They created all these rules of this is how you have to celebrate, and we so easily leave God out of really why we celebrate Christmas and Easter or Thanksgiving even. And all of those things should be solely surrounded by God, because he gave, for one, he came, he sent his son, put him on this earth to then allow him to die for us, and then we get to celebrate Thanksgiving here in terms of we get to thank God for living in a country that is so free. And yet I get so wrapped up in the details of all of that and forget why we really celebrate. And I think the Jews have done this for a long time, even with Purim, that they in a sense can forget in all of the legalism of it why they are celebrating. All right. You know, and I mean, part of me too, I think any Jew reading this, it seems a little crazy to even think that they could read this without seeing God. Even though God is not in here, I feel like most people who are somewhat alert would read this and still be pointed, as we have been, still be pointed back to God.
Well, like Diane said, I think Esther's one of her favorites, and she never even realized that God was ever mentioned until she said it. I mean, well, it's in the Bible.
So you just assume. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Unless you're really paying attention, you know.
Verse 23, so the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. So they just, now they've said, all right, we're going to do as you said, and we're going to celebrate as we go forth. Verse 24, for Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is cast lots, to crush and to destroy them. So it's just, we're just kind of giving a little brief summary of from an outside perspective of what's going on. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons shall be hanged on the gallows. So some suggest that this might be a Persian view of the events, just because of how they're looking at it. And the fact that the credit is given to the king, like where it says, but when it came before the king, verse 25, but when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return to his own head. Well, who was it that...
Right, the king issued the first edict.
Right. Who issued it? It wasn't the king. It was first one was Haman. Then the second one was Mordecai. Mordecai was
Esther,
the one who...
Yeah.
And Esther who wrote the edict. So... it really wasn't the king, but from this perspective, it looks like we're, you know, kind of giving credit to the
from
king.
From this, it almost looks like the king had nothing to do. It was like, oh, what happened? Oh, you can't do that.
One of the commentators said they wonder if this was a very intentional play where it says, but when it came before the king, it doesn't say King Ahasuerus, it just says the king. they wonder if it's kind of a play on trying to get your eyes to look upward as to who really was in charge of it the whole time. That it was the King of Kings, the one true king. Because, yeah, the king was never the one who gave the orders for anything in the whole book. He never seemed to make any decisions himself, ever.
Sounds good.
Right? All right. Yeah, so one of the commentators just said, maybe it was pointing to the direction of the one true king, who was the one who put into place all of these things that happened. There was divine intervention by the one true king, and he reversed all of the fortunes. He reversed Haman's fortune for his demise, and he reversed the Jews' fortune to their gain and placed them in a high power. Another commentator had said it was the decree. So, you know, there we have all these decrees that cannot be revoked in the Medes and the Persians, but it was the decree written on a heavenly scroll that was going to reverse what the Medes and the Persians law supposedly could not be revoked. The alert reader should be pointed to a higher hand as he reads this passage. God is hidden but active. All right. I think we'd covered that. Okay, verse 26. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the term pure. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter and of what they had faced in this matter and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at that time appointed every year. And these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation in every clan and province and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. So it is going to be a perpetual celebration from year to year. They were supposed to pass it on to their families. And like we already said, that so that it would not be forgotten, so that they could remember what God did here.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
In your research, did you ever find out when? Because at this point, there are Jews in Judah, mm-hmm. in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And then these are the Jews and
the Empire.
The Empire. When did they start celebrating? Do you know?
I did not come across anything. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, because they wouldn't have even known.
Right.
Right. Because they weren't part of it. Now they could have. When they found out, they could have still been happy. You know.
Sure.
Preserved their relatives, but.
Right.
But did what's our chronology here? And I can't say that I know the answer.
This is at the end, so right.
Nehemiah returned.
Yes, that's
during
true.
Artaxerxes' reign.
Yep.
So maybe he heard all about it and took it back with it.
Sure.
So this is according to John MacArthur. Esther ends in 473, so this is right before the 400 years of silence. Mm. Right, I mean, it's right before, so when is Nehemiah?
I just know that Nehemiah returned during the reign of Artaxerxes, who is after Xerxes.
Right. Oh, okay.
Artaxerxes is...
Yep.
Right, he's Xerxes' son, right.
Yep.
And he returned, I just believe he returned briefly after 12 years in Jerusalem.
Yep, and he comes back because he tells them he's going
back. He came
briefly
to Persia during that reign. I believe that's what it says near the end of Nehemiah.
So you're right. Maybe mm-hmm. he could have brought it back because he would have mm-hmm. then been part of it, or
right.
at least been a
right.
young man. You would think.
Right. You would think so. Yeah. Because it wouldn't have been.
Or maybe.
Because you think it was five.
After it, he might have grown up celebrating it.
Right.
Because Esther ends in 473 and Nehemiah is in 446.
Oh right. Okay.
Oh sorry. Yeah, the events in Nehemiah 1 commence late in the year 446.
Oh, so yes. Okay, so when he returned later, he was much older. So he would have been much older. So yeah, he definitely.
So he would have at least grown up celebrating it.
Right.
Oh, did he actually leave? Who was he cupbearer to? Artaxerxes then?
Artaxerxes, yep.
Oh,
came
so
out in
yeah,
the month he signed
the
20th year of King Artaxerxes.
He grew up with it.
He would have grown up
right.
with it, celebrating it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, maybe
yeah.
he instituted it back. I don't know.
And they were, I mean, I remember back in the beginning, they were allowed to send letters to family
right. well,
and communicate.
He heard
right.
from Jerusalem,
right.
and that's why he was sad.
Right. So it's possible they would have gotten word of it even before he went back.
But he would have at least been want a connection where he
right.
would have
mm-hmm.
grown up
right.
celebrating it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, to show. Right?
Give him all the rules.
This is how you're really supposed to do it. You were doing it wrong that whole time.
This is how we do it in church.
All right. So, yeah. So the festival is to be a reminder from generation to generation. All right. We covered that. Okay. Verse 29. I'll just go ahead and read it. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. So now we see that Esther is enacting her full authority as queen to confirm this second letter of Purim. She is going to use all of her queenly authority to make sure that it is in place.
Okay, question.
Yes.
I thought Mordecai was, she didn't have any parents. Daughter of, what's that?
I think it's just describing who she is.
She did have
yes,
parents,
she
just did.
Right, right. So they're just describing this is who she belongs to. Yes, Mordecai. Yeah, yeah.
And if you look back, I think in chapter 2,
it also says her.
Oh, I don't know that it says. Oh, I thought it did. It doesn't. It says he Mordecai was bringing up
Hadassah.
His sister, his
yeah.
uncle's daughter,
mm-hmm.
for she had no father or mother.
Right.
So I guess now we find out who her
right.
her mother's name was.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. Verse 30, letters were sent to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in the words of peace and truth. The words of, some say, well, mine say peace and truth. Some might say words of goodwill and assurance, but goodwill and assurance just essentially means words of peace and truth. So it's benevolent in character, but also instructive in content of what they were to do. 31, in these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them. And that just implies that if you were within the walled city, you were to celebrate it on the 15th day. If you were not in the walled city, you were to celebrate it on the 14th day. Because if you were trying to be accurate in where your region actually, when it actually happened. as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. History is important to the Jews because it literally proves the perfection to which God keeps his promises, whether God seems abundantly present or apparently absent. And Martin Luther said that proof that the Bible is real is the Jews. The Jews are proof of that, because and keeping a record of that is so important, because we see over and over how God has continued to protect them. It's just incredible. This small little nation has been preserved for so many years. All right, any questions before we get into 10? I think we will be able to do these couple verses before we end. But any questions before we wrap up 9? All right, chapter 10. Can someone read for us verses 1 through 3?
Now King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with his many kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people, and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation.
Great. All right, so he is now imposing this tax. So, you know, the empire is still going to be the empire because he is still going to put out. Earlier, like back in when Esther became queen, it said that it sounded like they gave kind of a remission of taxes. I don't know if you guys remember that. Mm-hmm. But so now he's going to reimpose those taxes. So he's still getting his money. So we're reminded of Xerxes' extent of power. He, you know, he still longs for the power and the money, as we saw back in chapter 1. His power and honor are ever more secure, and normality has returned to the Persian Empire. He could have been tempted to gain wealth through Haman's plot originally, because remember, Haman offered him up the 10,000 talents, and, you know, that would have been really tempting to take. But he just reverted back to the normal way of government, which is tax everybody for their money. Still, Xerxes' own personal interest remains central. Despite what has just transpired, he still wants to make sure that his interests are continued to be abated. Even with Esther as queen, the empire selfishness is still the same. And then verse 2, and all the acts of his power and might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. Now, this is the greatest reversal. To have someone like Haman, who was so evil and had such hatred, in second in command, and then in the blink of an eye, his life is taken out. And it wasn't just anybody that was put in his place. Like, it could have been, you know, anyone else. It could have been another person who hated the Jews. But now Mordecai is held to his position and put in his position. And not only that, but he is loved and popular among, I mean, of course, you know, he's going to be popular. He saved all their lives. He should be popular among them. But now he is popular with all those, in the empire and well, with the Jews. So we see such a contrast of Mordecai and Haman. Mordecai is one who, or Haman was self-indulgent and self-centered. Mordecai is one who spoke well of others. He was famous and popular because of that. But Haman was the enemy of the Jews. Haman was committed to destruction and hate. Mordecai was focused on goodness and peace. Mordecai then also had a lasting legacy that served his people. He served his people and the king without compromise. He was able to do both, which is pretty impressive concerning who you're, who's ruler of you. He desired to do good for both the king and for the people of the empire at the time. So this is truly the ultimate reversal and the ultimate deliverance of seeing these people saved.
Right, because they were supposed to be annihilated, and now he's basically ruler.
Right, right.
Because Ahasuerus just seems to be easily
right. Maneuvered, right.
Maneuvered, exactly. So right. And who really rules, it seems kind right. of like Mordecai.
And while this is absolutely something to celebrate, Mordecai can only live for so long.
I have an interesting note here. It says, Mordecai held the office of first minister no longer than 8 years.
Mm.
For secular history records that another man was in that office in 465. Mm.
Okay, yeah. So not super long, right? So similar to us, to only be able to have people in office for
right.
8 years that can do what we want them to do. Deliverance that rests on the influence of a single individual who will grow old and die is partial and temporary. We have a yet redemptive reversal from the one king, the Prince of Peace, whose reign will never end. And peace in him was established for us on the cross, right? Now we get to have that feast forever of the ultimate reversal of our redemption. And what we were deemed for death and despair and eternally separated, and now we get to enjoy forever being united with him and in communion with him. All right. Well, let me just double check, but I think that is it. Okay, we're done. Well, thank you, ladies, for being here for it. And it was
a good study.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be fun next week if we could do a review and just hear from you guys what you guys took away from it, or, you know, just kind of go over, especially with, you know, several ladies not being able to be here today. But then we had kind of talked about maybe celebrating. We could do like a little Purim kind of celebration, have the kids come and dress up. And it's fine. Yeah.
Well, because, okay, so next week's Thanksgiving, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have December. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be out 2 weeks
Right.
Because I'm going to be in Texas.
Right.
Well, not 2 weeks, but it is 2 Tuesdays. So yeah. I'm going to not be.
Sure.
So what if we did a review next week? Or we could just mm-hmm. be off next week, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could have our little party sometime in December, and then we start Leviticus in January. Otherwise, we get like one or two classes.
Sure.
And then we're off.
We forget right. 1 week. Can you imagine 1 week?
I think that's fine. We could even have a fellowship another day or something, and then just start Leviticus in either the last week of December or in January, and then
Right. Should we just do like a fellowship time next week and then.
Or I don't know what people. There's not many people here, but Thanksgiving plans. Right. Thanksgiving plans
That's true. This year, that's true.
So, I mean, it's up to.
Or health things, obviously. People are being more cautious.
Right. That's what I'm saying is. Not,
right.
Maybe people, just.
Should we just not.
Say, let's just
yeah. That's fine. That's totally fine. Totally fine.
First week of December, mm-hmm. we can either do a review or.
Yeah. And if we don't get to it, we don't get to it. It's not a big deal. Yeah. But, yeah.
Or you maybe like a review fellowship day where we mm-hmm. start review and then hang out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Could do that. Yeah. All right.
We could have it at my house.
Some place mm-hmm. or something or whatever.
Yeah, that sounds good.
More details to come.
All right. Well.
Okay. So are you going to let it?
We'll make an announcement. Yeah. And we can send an email.
Do you want me to send something to, or you can send whatever.
Yeah.
To Joyce. Just
yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I can do that. All right.
And they'll announce it. We can have them announce it in church too.
Yep. Okay. For sure.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. For Sunday.
Okay.
So nothing next week. And then probably.
We'll just probably at some point have a fellowship. Yeah.
December fellowship.
Day. Yeah. That sounds good.
An exciting Leviticus.
Yay! I'm excited. I think it'll be good.
Well, it's actually been quite fascinating, even studying up. If you were a Jew and studying the Pentateuch, the very first book you would study is Leviticus.
Because
for them, it is the most important book.
I can see that. I started studying it on my own a couple of months ago when we finished Exodus. Yeah. And I have this other notebook at home where I started lists. And then, you know, it started with all the repetition. And then COVID hit. And then I'm like, this is so not ministering to my soul. I need a book that ministers to my soul. So I'm like, bye-bye, you know. And then I, you know, did something else, whatever. So I never, and then you were gonna do it at some point. I'm like, oh. And then let me know. I think that obviously there's a lot of important information, but there's so many repetitions with subtleties
yes.
that it would be great to, you know, get it all capitalized.
Well, and I think that having a big picture,
the bigger
view
picture
helps not get lost in the clean and unclean. And
well,
my question is always like, when was anyone ever clean?
Ever? Right.
To me, the other thing with the subtle differences in the burnt offerings and this and that,
so
I even
we'll
made lists.
Yep.
Here's all the burnt offerings, and then this is all the.
Well, there's the grain offering and the peace offering and
the drink offerings.
No, the burnt, but then the killing ones. All the ones that are
the peace
of animals, but they're so subtly different.
Mm. Oh, of the burnt offering.
Yeah.
So there's
then,
the bull, the sheep, and the bird.
Yeah.
And that, well.
No, not even that. What am I thinking of?
Like, you're saying, because there was the peace offering that they partook in.
The sin offering and the guilt
offering. And the what one?
Guilt.
Yes, the sin, the guilt, and the burnt.
Yes.
And all three were different, those three.
Yes.
And I made all these lists going, let's just microscopically see the differences, try to figure, you know. I needed to somehow, I wanted to compartmentalize it so my brain could get it in a state where I could kind of get the big picture. So I love that. That would be wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be good. I mean, and
little pictures.
It's no wonder that it's the first one that they study, because they love all the laws and the regulations. So, oh man.
I know, but for us, it's like the one that nobody ever studies.
Right. I know.
There's no story in
right.
it. Even numbers with its lists and whatever, there's story.
Right.
In it.
Yep.
And the Leviticus is just all laws.
Mm-hmm. Oh man. All right. Well, can someone close us in prayer and we will head out.